Session number 10420, rule 34.
Colonel W.I. Watson, Reel 34. You were talking about guarding aerodromes in the...
Yes. It was extremely difficult to try and organize any form of operation against, possible operation against parachutists. Of course, there were all sorts of regiments of different, one kind and another. And... as I think I mentioned on the last tape, on bright moonlight night, we did an operation, an operation against so-called parachutists, and the whole of the Poona Horse swept down the aerodrome in grand style in the moonlight, to the intense annoyance of the Royal Air Force, and we were never allowed thereafter to go anywhere near or on any of the landing grounds. And had the parachutists descended there, I really don't know quite what had happened. But mercifully, they never did. And on the 1st of September, after we'd been there only a few days, I received orders that we were to move into the Alamein line and relieve the New Zealanders. And this we did. We set off very shortly after that. And
can you recall the movement into the line?
Yes, very much so. We didn't go absolutely direct. We were moved into a reserve area for 24 hours. I think we were due to stay there longer, but we didn't. We did went into a sort of reserve area near Rewisit Station, near the railway line. But we were only there 24 hours, 36 hours, and we moved into the line itself. Happily, there was a sandstorm, and therefore the enemy couldn't have seen us, and we relieved the New Zealanders. Now, our position in the Alamein line was right in the south. The Germans that had attacked the line earlier on at Alam Halfa and had got a bloody nose and been sent back. But the line hadn't been straightened out. And we, in fact, were on the northern side, as it were, of the gap that the Germans had made. And we looked south over an area of 1,000 yards or more, no man's land, onto the area of the Munasib Depression. The Munasib Depression was one of those extraordinary deep depressions in the desert, with absolutely cliffs all round and a sandy floor at the bottom. And the Italians' Folgore Division was holding that depression. On our left, I think, was the 8th Battalion, then came some Green Hearts, and then the line turned back again, and the 44th Division were in there, and way far away in the distance was the famous Katara Depression. You could just to say see it when it was clear. And we looked southwards over this no man's land over which the New Zealanders fought to push the Germans back.
What kind of positions were you taking up then? What was the defensive situation there?
Well, they were the defensive positions. They were on a slight ridge, most of them were on the forward side of this ridge, and we had a very prominent little pimple in our line, in our area, called Alum Nile, and it wasn't occupied. We had nothing on the top of it, nor did the gunners use it as an OP. On the reverse slope would be the reserve companies and the headquarter company, and I had battalion headquarters on the reverse slope. It was soon became very transparent that it was unwise to walk about too much in the daylight if there was any movement of any sort. You might get shelled. And there was intermittent shelling all the time we were there. And we suffered a certain amount of casualties. I know this little pimple Alum Nile was bombed at one time by the Germans. They dropped 11 bombs, but 8 failed to explode. They all had to be dealt with by the sappers. By September the 5th, we were settled in. I had a hole. It was much rockier than in the Zala line. And I had a hole blown for me, a hole in the ground blown for me by the sappers and at night, and it brought down shellfire. The enemy reacted in no uncertain terms. And so my hole in the ground was at no depth at all. I couldn't put a bed in it. And I did, in fact, sleep the whole of the time we were up in that part of the Alamein line on a sheet of corrugated iron. It made rather a springy bed, wrapped up in a blanket. And I know, too, that on a later occasion, my wash basin, which was standing on a sort of tripod outside my hut, a shell dropped within 4 yards of it. Fortunately, I wasn't there, but my baton was inside, making my bed inside. And the shell blew a hole right through the basin, but I was able to have sufficient water for it to wash in, although I couldn't fill it up to the top. But there was that sort of spasmodic shelling all the time, practically.
If you couldn't dig down, how did they form shelters?
Oh, the sappers would have blown the holes, you see, in the ground.
Is this the same for the men?
For the men, the same. Yes. I know I walked over to see Tony Erdi Wilmot, who was commanding C Company, one morning, and he was sitting outside with Sergeant Watts, sitting on the ground outside his company headquarters, and he walked towards me to meet me, and the shell came over and failed to explode at my feet, which I thought was very obliging of it. But that was the sort of thing. If there was too much movement, the Folgore spotted it, and the Italian artillery was very good. I know another time, the East Yorks, there was a company of East Yorks attached to us to make up the third company in the battalion. It left us eventually. And the fellow put his, he was being shelled, I think, or perhaps, yes, he was being shelled. Everybody was below ground. Nobody was hurt except the company commander, who put his arm out to get his tin hat, and a piece of shrapnel went through his arm. That gives you an idea. And on another occasion, there was a dogfight overhead, and a German plane was trying to get back to its own lines and was blazing, ablaze. And I think it dropped it crashed in the 9th Battalion area or on our right, not in our area. On the right, and I saw it crash, and the New Zealanders who were there, the anti-aircraft gunners, were there, ran across to the plane, and they were immediately shelled by the enemy. You see, that's the sort of atmosphere there was. while we were in the line there.
What effects had shelling on men, on soldiers? Was it a particularly harrowing experience to be?
No, it didn't. They were so foolish at times. They didn't take precautions. Now, I had a very good soldier called Jones, another Teesdale regular here. He was hit and killed. He died of wounds in the other main line.
Was there any enemy weapon which the men feared more than any other?
No. But then, at the same time, we had to do as much training as we could. Of course, we were very, very weak and untrained. And so one company at dawn would pull out of the line and go back about, march back 6 miles, and do a certain amount of training in the desert, and then come back again under cover of darkness. And then another company would go out. Meanwhile, a complete company was being formed at the IBD or somewhere at the back, and eventually came up and took the place of the East York Company.
What form did the training take, Kirk?
Well, they could do platoon movement and use their rifles. They couldn't fire, but they could use weapon training and movement.
Was it basically of a defensive nature?
Yes. Yeah, and then they'd march back again. But we were told we had to do as much training as we could. You see, the carriers could do a certain amount of carrier driving.
Was the line that you occupied, was it heavily wired in?
Yes, well, I'd come to that later. It was heavily wired in and mined. And each night we used to send out patrols. Sometimes they were extremely successful, and other times they weren't. We had a... what the calendar was. Anyhow, on one occasion, I sent out a patrol commanded by a chap called Cox, I think. He was the East Yorks, from one of the East Yorks, from their company. To start with, there was a wire fence went down direct from our positions to the Italian in the Munasib Depression. And that wire fence was used by both sides for the patrol to crawl as a guide for the patrol. And so they met, used to meet out in no man's land. But anyhow, I sent Cox from the East Yorks out, and they met an Italian patrol. I think they were Italian, not of the Folgore Division. And they had a sector. Now, Cox's servant was killed, and Cox was slightly wounded, and his sergeant was even more wounded, more severely wounded. And I think they had to be left out at night. Anyhow, they did crawl back into the 8th Battalion lines. The sergeant had to have his leg taken off and died, but Cox's servant was killed out there in no man's land. And I got Father, he was a RC, and I got Father Nesbitt from the 8th Battalion, the RC Padre, and asked him if he'd go out and bury this chap out in no man's land with the help of a patrol and some chaps to dig a grave. And the good Padre Nesbitt did, and they buried him. The next night, a patrol went out. You see, the patrol would keep watch while the chaps were digging, and they buried him. The next morning, you could see right away across in no man's land, a little white cross. They put a little white cross. All our pioneers, incidentally, carried pioneer platoon carried a supply of white crosses, and they'd put his name on, and it was standing there. Father Nisbet was a great character in the whole of the brigade, and he was killed in Normandy. He went with the 8th Battalion right through and was eventually killed in Normandy, Father Nisbet. Well, then, out there in no man's land were, I think, two or three carriers, and also an armoured scout car. And we were determined to get them in with the light aid LEDs to put them on an LED and bring them in. But of course, you had to do it at night. You had to make sure that the Germans hadn't put mines around them. I mean, the Folgore hadn't put mines around them as booby trap. And likewise, the scout car. And this was a tremendous task to do under the noses of the Italians. We did manage to get them all in. Not necessarily at the first go, but we prepared the way and eventually got an LAD up there and brought them all in. The scout car, got it sent back to the LAD or the vehicle, wherever they repaired the vehicles. I knew the chap because he kept the garage in Darlington, in Grange Road, Darlington. So I knew him well enough. And I said, does this belong to me? Recovered this scout car, because I thought, by Jove, Italian commander having a scout car, one up on all his friends. I was told, yes, certainly it would be mine, and I could have it back. Well, unfortunately, the division commander in his divisional orders put in that it was a very well carried out exercise and great credit to the battalion and all the rest. And the owners of the scout car saw it, and of course I never got my scout car. They claimed it back. But on another occasion, I had two South African pilots sent up to spend a day or two with the battalion. And I said, well, one of the first things you're going to do is you're going out on a patrol tonight into no man's land. And they didn't like the idea of this at all. I said, I'll come with you so far. I'll come through the minefield out into no man's land just before it gets dark. Anyhow, they went out safely returned. And next morning, I think they came to battalion headquarters to have for breakfast, and we were started to be shelled. And that was the end. They just said they were far safer in the air than it was in the Alamein line, and they went back home. But the patrols we sent out weren't always successful. Now, I had to send out some new boys, you might say, a new officer, I think, and I had to get Tim Chamberlain to take them out on a patrol, and of course he was killed, and one or two others were wounded. But mostly we were successful in those very active night work which we carried out in no man's land.
Was dominating no man's land
we
important?
Had to dominate. That's what we wanted to do, to dominate no man's land.
What kind of equipment would a typical patrol have with it? Did they carry rifles? Or
it would have a rifle, yes. Some of the chaps would have Thompson submachine guns. All their buckles would be, anything that rattled would be tied tight with string or covered with some rag or something like that.
Did they blacken it?
The darken their faces, yes. But there was an appreciable dip. You could look right away across No Man's Land. It was all laid out before you. And then you could see the Monastic Depression. And what's more, in the Monastic Depression, if there were any vehicles moving, you could see a great cloud of smoke coming out of it, out of the sand coming out of it in the heat.
So how, did you find the Italians as opponents at this time?
Well, these chaps, the Folgore, were very good because they were Italian parachutists in an infantry role. Oh, yes, they were the cream of the Italian army. But Italian gunners were always good. They may have old-fashioned guns, but they were very good at their job.
Did you take any prisoners?
I can't remember. Don't think we did, no. I did, in fact. We had visits, of course, from Horrocks and Monte. Horrocks was, you felt when he came up to battalion headquarters, and you felt that when he came and talked to you, you'd do almost anything for him. And I know he came up on one occasion and said, we really must get things smartened up now in the 8th Army. And he said, I reckon that the 11th Hussars and the 10th Hussars, I think, and the Royal Horse Artillery are the best regiments in the 8th Army at present. But, gentlemen, I've not seen yours. I remember him saying that. And he said, we really must get things smartened up. The saluting is so bad. I actually was saluted twice this morning at Corps headquarters, almost for the first time. But you felt you couldn't have had a more pleasanter corps commander. But he came up to my battalion headquarters, and brigade headquarters, on more than one occasion, as did Monte.
How did you find Monte when you first met him?
When I first met him, he was absolutely splendid. When he gave his first talk before the Battle of Alamein, it was a marvelous talk. It went on 40 minutes, but it only seemed to be 10. I was given. Now the plan that of 151 brigades in the attack which was to take place was that we would, the 6th Battalion at least, would go out into No Man's Land and occupy No Man's Land. And Horrocks, I remember saying that. We regretted that the role of the battalion or the brigade wouldn't be very great because it was in such a depleted state and hadn't had all the training necessary. But it would be an important role. And that was the role we were to do. We were to get up quietly at night, having dumped stuff out in No Man's Land, and go and occupy it right under the noses of the Italians. Meanwhile, the 44th Division on our left, round the corner, was to attack, and which they duly did and wasn't very successful. But, of course, we never did carry out the role. I mean, you've only got to read the history books and see that we were moved eventually. All the way down to the north, the other end of the, and took part in Operation Supercharge.
So you didn't get out into No Man's Land, or it was changed?
No. I was granted a week's leave, and I left the Alamein line for a week's leave in Cairo, and I sat under the trees in the Gezira Sporting Club, making a plan up to move out into No Man's Land whilst I was watching the cricket, mentally making a plan up but it was never put into operation.
So you would get an objective given to you.
Yes.
And you as battalion commander would then plan how that objective was to be attained.
Yes. And how the move would take place, and what stores we would want out there, and that sort of thing, and the gap we'd have to make through a minefield, and that sort of thing. But it never came off, of course. But I mean, it was a. It just showed that the Battle of Alamein didn't go quite according to Monty's plan. In fact, it was a very near thing.
While you were in the line in this particular position, you obviously weren't under a great deal of activity. There wasn't a great deal of activity going on.
No, there was very little activity at all. Where there was, Rommel had a tremendous line of communication, and all his stuff had to, and we were hammering it in there from the air the whole time. Our air force was predominant. The Germans had been predominant in the Gazala line, but in the Alamein line, you could see those 12 Boston bombers go over day after day, with an escort of fighters. And the Rommel's lines of communication were huge, and whereas they were short, and Monty had said, didn't he, that he wasn't going to attack until he was absolutely got everything in apple pie order.
Was there a feeling of building up the morale?
Yes, there was indeed, because at this time the Highland Division had come out with a great deal of bombast, and they'd put HD on every mortal thing, and my chaps couldn't stand it. And I would, Monty and Horrocks would sit, now talk to all your chaps, you'd tell them all this and that, what's going to happen, and the role you're going to play. And I went round at nights in the evenings to some of the companies and told them, and they used to say, but the Highland Division's not going to go front, is it? They were frightfully jealous. They thought they weren't going to, if they were going to be left out of it,